Golf Smarter number 325, published on March 20, 2012, is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Golf columnist for the Wall Street Journal, John Paul Newport.
This is Golf Smarter. Sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, John Paul.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for agreeing to participate with today's show.
Excited to be here.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. To give some background, you are a columnist for the Wall Street Journal.
That is correct.
Among other things that you cover, you do their golf columns. Are you the exclusive golf journalist for the Wall Street Journal?
Well, sometimes some people write about the business side of golf, but my exclusive job is to write a weekly golf column every Saturday in the paper. So it's a great gig.
So you wrote, what, about 50 columns a year, and they're all golf-related?
Correct.
But you're not covering the tour? You are?
I don't. Maybe one out of six, I would guess, has to do with professional golf. It's not trying to cover the tour. I go to the four majors every year, and sometimes one or two other tournaments, depending on some particular story I might be pursuing. But mostly the mandate is for people who play golf, who love golf, or who even don't play but are just interested for some reason in certain subjects relating to golf that I can come up with. It's what they might find interesting, what guys or women would be talking about on the grill room afterwards. Sometimes there are more social, you know, societal issues, mm-hmm. like the real estate crisis, or like when there was a problem with Northern Trust sponsoring golf tournaments when the banks were being bailed out. You know, that was a golf-related column that had a lot of interest outside of just golfers. Although I'm not after the business angle of golf, even though it's the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, that's interesting. But there are people who cover the business angle of golf.
Yeah, when they're stories. Every once in a while, I'll write something in the regular paper. I mean, this is the regular paper, but I mean in the news holes of the regular paper relating to golf. But that's rare.
And how long have you been doing this for them?
6 years almost.
So that means you've been to the majors, all four majors, for the last 6 years or longer?
Yeah, yeah.
How awesome is that, that somebody pays you to do this?
Yes.
Do you like going to professional golf tournaments?
Well, you know, it's matches? Funny. I mean, it's like a lot of things. Anytime it's your job, it's different than going recreationally. And Those 4 weeks a year when I'm at the majors, plus the Ryder Cup every other year, those are the hardest weeks of my year because in those weeks I am writing like a preview story on Thursday and game story like on Saturday. Plus, I have to be blogging online also. We really do try to cover that as an event. So I am writing round the clock. At the Masters last year, a very good friend of mine who introduced me and my wife was attending, and I was in the press center, you know, right in the heart of the golf course, and we tried several times to meet up, and I couldn't even come out to shake his hand. I was so busy. So it's exciting, it's wonderful, it's great in retrospect, but it's hard work, which I know I don't get any sympathy for that.
No, you don't. There was a period of my life where I was traveling around the country going to ball games, and my friends hated me.
Right.
Because it was like, you're just going to ball games. Yeah, it's pretty much what I do. I go to baseball games all over the country.
One of the things about business travel in general, you know, people say, hey, you're going to San Francisco or someplace interesting. But whenever you're traveling for your company, you're basically on a meter, like a taxi meter. It's costing money.
Yes.
And any extra hour that you're just, you know, you have to justify, you know, why they're paying that extra hour for you to be there. So.
What makes not just the Masters, but the majors, what makes them special from a journalist perspective? And I promise we will get to the topic of why I asked you to be here, but this is fascinating to me. I'm sorry.
Well, it is pretty interesting because, I mean, a tournament's a tournament, and you'd think, why is winning a major, you know, such a big deal? But the reason it's such a big deal to a large degree is because it's such a big deal. Historically, they are the ones that count the most. Therefore, to win one, the golfers know in their heads it's how you will be defined for your career. So the pressure is – the self-inflicted pressure is much, much greater. They know how important it is. Plus, it attracts the biggest fields of the year. So – it is harder to win a major than other tournaments.
And you're a reporter, not a pundit?
Well, it's a funny little line in there, but mostly my columns are very reported. I don't just sit back and wax wise and criticize people. I try to have an idea and interview a lot of people and find out information and convey information.
So it's not a good idea to ask you. So is Tiger ever going to win again or even another major?
Oh, yeah. No, that's a legitimate question.
Okay.
I just can't imagine that he won't win again. And I've never doubted that he would win again. He's only 36. He's a great player. He knows how to win. There's no question, you know, his health got back and that awfulness sort of receded a little bit and he could focus more and people let him focus more on golf, that he's going to – I never felt he would return to form. I mean, I never felt – a doubt that he would return to form. The biggest doubt in my mind was whether maybe something was lost, like nerves or putting, you know, strokes. And it remains to be seen coming down the stretch, you know, in a major, whether he can still pull it off. So that's more of a question. But I feel sure he's going to win a lot of tournaments still.
Are there specific golfers that you enjoy covering as personalities versus as golfers?
You know, some of my favorite golfers are Phil Mickelson, Steve Stricker, Jim Furyk, Rory McIlroy.
Because?
Phil is a guy that will give you an interesting, straight-out, responsive answer to questions, unlike a lot of them. He thinks of himself as an intellect and a wit, and he is. He's not afraid to try to say something new or thoughtful. He's thinking it over.
Well, like guys, most athletes who have like that great scene from Bull Durham when he's teaching them what are the cliches that you have to say, and most athletes are generally like that. They just have these standard answers.
Yeah.
But Phil, like Brian Wilson of the Giants, the pitcher for the Giants, who you just never know what he was going to say, and he thought about every answer that he gave. It felt like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those people are wonderful. I mean, he's a little – some people say he's a little full of himself, and maybe he is, but I like him. I really like him personally. He's famous for standing there for hours giving autographs. He's generally a very personable guy. So he sometimes will talk about economics and deliver ultimatums on, you know, what should be done, as if, you know, his opinion is more valuable than everybody else's a little bit. But, I mean, when you're just starved for somebody that's saying something real, I mean, Tiger is the opposite of that. Tiger is actually pretty forthcoming on explaining his golf game and, you know, technique, and he actually reveals a lot of stuff in that respect. But you get him off subject, and he's just a genius. He's like a chess grandmaster about five moves ahead of you in not revealing things.
Gives you the evil eye.
Yeah, well, he does that some. He did that recently. Mm. I've interviewed him three or four times one-on-one, and you know, he's genuinely charming and he can be very witty. I mean, I know all this stuff that was going on was just awful, and I wouldn't necessarily want him to be my my best friend, but man, he's very witty and he's very smart and he can be communicative when he's on the subject that he wants to be communicative about, and then just a stonewaller on anything else.
But we can't let go of him. It's almost like Mike Tyson in some ways, how we're just waiting for Tyson to come. You know, it's amazing. We can't let go. We just are there waiting for him to succeed or crash and burn. But we keep watching.
He's absolutely riveting. He's in the room and your eye is on him.
Oh, is that right? When he walks in, does everybody, it's like you feel him walking in the room?
Yeah. Well, I do mean that literally, but I also mean it figuratively. Mm-hmm. It's like when he's in the room of a tournament, you just can't help but wonder what's up with him.
Right.
Oh. It's possible if he shrank into mediocrity and was just became a journeyman, you know, that would not be the case anymore. But thus far, he always seems to manage to. There's something's in the news about him, even when he's not playing well.
Well,
and
the players always talked about that. If he's in the hunt, you just no matter where you are on the course, you can feel his presence.
Mm-hmm. That actually, I think, is one of the most interesting things that he's going to face when he gets his game back, which I think he really has now. Is these young guys? They're not, supposedly they're not afraid of him. They're not going to wilt. They've been brought up in a new era, and they're just as daring as Tiger was when he was that age.
Mm-hmm.
And they're younger, and they hit the ball farther, and they're better. And you know, that aura is. We'll see. It'd be very interesting to see how the other.
And we cover this on this podcast a lot, and that's, I think, why we call it Golf Smarter. But the young people, and I think Tiger's coming to prove that, you know, the young people with all the game, but without the mental element of it, you know, Tiger seemed to have that in his younger years and has seemed to have, you know, his brain has gotten in the way, his emotions have gotten in the way. I'm curious about young players and, you know, even though they have the tools physically, do they have the emotional and, capacity to pull off that kind of pressure, which clearly it is.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a rare package to be a world ranked golf master. You've got to have the physical skills. You've got to have the temperament. You've got to be able to live the life on the road that they live. And then you've got to have that intangible set of mental qualities that you're talking about. Dustin Johnson's, I think, kind of an interesting case in point. I happened to be at the Q School about 4 years ago when he first qualified for the tour in his first shot. And people were saying, you should go watch this guy. And I walked with his college coach a little bit. And he said, Dustin just always had that ability to never get nervous. He just rose to the occasion. He's the type of guy that wanted the ball, you know, in the basketball game to take the last shot. And he really does have that quality, but he's made some very bad mental errors in the height of the heat of majors, like at the US Open at
Pebble Beach
where he fell apart.
And Sunday.
And the British Open, he hit an approach shot last year out of bounds when he was in contention on the 15th hole, I think it was. So, you know, maybe that lack of introspection and that kind of natural ability only takes you so far. You know, he's a phenom as an athlete and as a golfer, but that's an interesting case study to monitor in terms of mental.
But still, they have to have some of that or they wouldn't be at the top of the leaderboard on Sunday on a PGA Tour and a major. I mean, you know, there's Q School, there's all the competition growing up, there's the juniors, there's college. You know, you've got to be able to get past that. So you've got to have some of those tools in place.
Mm-hmm. You do.
Once you get to the show.
Yeah, Dustin's won a tournament every year he's been on tour. But, you know, somebody like that, for instance, he was always so good and so long and he bombed things and he played other sports and he was a dominant kind of figure. So his propensity not to crash under pressure was just that he knew he could beat everybody. But then finally you get up, you know, in a major and for the first time, something different's happening to him that he hasn't experienced. That's what they say about being in the hunt in majors. It's you got to put yourself in that position and it's very strange what happens.
Yeah, I guess you can have some swagger for your whole life when everyone tells you you're the best around, you're the best around. And then you get into a room full of the best. And, it, you know, all of a sudden you as a young person, you can really feel intimidated.
Yeah.
And especially it's like, you know, and I love hearing when they say, I've watched you ever since I was a kid, you know, and it makes, you know, whenever you hear that, you know, the person saying, I'm not that old. Wait a minute. You know, it's like, it's really painful to hear someone say that. I remember you when I was four. so that puts you both in a position of, you know, dominance and submission, especially on a competitive level.
Yeah. One of the things I've always felt about Tiger and his success earlier in his career was I mean, he had many, many advantages, including being in the public eye since he was on the Mike Douglas show at
right.
2 or 4 or whenever he was. But he was a little bit lucky, too. That's one contributing factor, not the whole explanation. But he won a lot of tournaments, like the U.S. Amateurs, when he made a 50-foot putt on the 17th green at TPC Sawgrass to go on to win a U.S. Amateur. And then I think the next U.S. Amateur, he had some amazing comeback. And those putts and things didn't have to go in. And then he had a few other key things that happened here and there. So in his own mind and in the minds of others, but mostly in his own mind, he became this kind of child of destiny, you know, where he was the one that those things happened to. And that builds and builds, and it's a self-fulfilling mindset, I think, to some degree. And some of it was a little bit lucky that, you know, he didn't, that putt went in, and then that gave him, you know, to the next event. And so now, all of a sudden, when he's coming back, I think he's really on the brink in terms of his game of being back. But maybe that armor, that mental armor that he's always had is, that's going to be very interesting to see.
It's interesting, you've been with him, you've talked to him one-on-one. Did he carry himself? Did he present himself as, this is my destiny? That's kind of arrogant to walk around with your head up saying, no, I'm destined for this greatness.
No.
Or was he to have some humility about it?
Yeah, he had, I wouldn't call it humility exactly, but it wasn't that kind of arrogance. I mean, his father said some, you know, he said, this is the chosen one stuff. So he heaped that on him,
yeah.
Which of course wasn't probably welcomed by Tiger, but it was there. He's not arrogant in that way himself, but you know, there's a confidence to him, certainly. Mm-hmm. And he knows he's as good as he was. So, But he doesn't say, you won't catch him saying ridiculous, arrogant things, because he doesn't. That's not how he thinks. He's more in the moment than that.
Hmm. Fascinating. If you don't mind, I need to mention the wonderful folks over at Audible.com, because this episode of the Golf Smarter podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. Probably including the Wall Street Journal. For a free audiobook of your choice, you get to go to audiblepodcast.com. You are suggested to go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter and sign up for a free audiobook with your as your first book. And I would love to know, John Paul, do you listen to audiobooks, or are you just working and writing all the time? You don't have time to read or even listen to books.
No, I've listened to quite a few audiobooks over the years. I find myself cycling in and out of them for various reasons. Right now, I'm in more of a podcast phase, as it happens.
Good for you. Yay.
They're great at the gym. You know, you can download a 30-minute podcast for a 30-minute spin on the exercise cycle. But
absolutely.
But, one of the last audiobooks I listened to was Life by Keith Richards.
Uh-huh.
It's narrated by Johnny Depp, but unannounced, at least I wasn't aware of it. It's sort of in the middle of the book. Keith Richards himself comes on and narrates a few of the chapters, and you know, it's great to hear his British limey voice in there. And I actually ended up writing a column based on listening to that book, because I was so struck by the way he mastered the guitar and how similar the steps of mastery for him mastering the guitar were to the way like great golfers master playing golf. He was enthralled by it as a young kid, just like golfers were with golf, and he really mastered the fundamentals, the technical stuff, long before he became, you know, part of the Rolling Stones. And that allowed him, when that became second nature, to kind of go off into the, you know, the places that he did with the band. And that's so much what has to happen ideally when a young person's coming up with golf. So I got a column out of the last Audible book I listened to.
Awesome. Well, thank you for the recommendation. We've never talked about that book, but it sounds, and again, for me, I like listening to biographies. because especially when you get someone either who sounds like the person or knows the person, or the, you know, the author themselves, the subject themselves reads it, there's something more to it. You're hearing it and believing it in a very different way. So this is probably Johnny Depp can be anybody. So it's perfect.
Yeah, he's definitely not Johnny Depp there. I mean, it's a first person account, and he
pulls it off, huh?
He pulls it off. You even though it's an American accent, you believe you're listening to Keith Richards. Yeah. And then at one point you actually are.
Well, there it is. There's your recommendation for this week's Audible. Sign up. It's Life by Keith Richards, narrated by Johnny Depp. And that could be your first audiobook when you sign up for audible.com. Just go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter, and that will let them know that you've heard about it right here on the Golf Smarter podcast. Thank you, John Paul. I appreciate the recommendation. I still want to get to your article on golf's biggest illusions, but one of the people that you mentioned that fascinates you, that you enjoy covering, is Rory McIlroy, the second coming. What?
Yeah.
What is it about Rory that intrigues you?
I happened to watch. I started out watching him at the U.S. Open last summer at Congressional. I watched his first tee shot, and he was playing so well. I watched the first three rounds, every shot he hit. I didn't get to do the last round, but
you're watching on TV. You're not there live.
No, covering. I was watching inside the ropes, following him around the course.
Oh wow! Okay,
fabulous. He has just a joy de vivre about playing golf that few of them have. And when he's playing well, he has this kind of jaunty stride that just he just can't wait to get to his next shot. Hmm. And there's a power to him. I don't know quite how to describe it, other than it's sort of like a very fast, wonderful car that normally tools along at 60, but you just know that, you know, just tap on the brakes and it could go up to 120 in like 3 seconds. And he can sort of, there's that, it's beautifully tool thing, and it's just got the surplus power, and he can add 25 yards to his drives whenever he wants to. It's just there. There's just the sense that it's not just that he's playing well. You don't feel like he's at the limit of what he's able to do when he's playing well.
Yeah.
He's just cruising, you know. And then
he is one of those people that you see when he's walking and his head is high. You can see that his head is high, the way he carries himself. That his shoulders are back and he's proud.
He's absolutely a delightful guy, too. I mean, he's everything you see. I talked to his father some, and his father and him together in the hotel lobby a little bit. I just was nearby when they were greeting each other, and I mean, he's a normal bloke, you know. It's just but I mean, he knows he's the greatest golfer in the world right now, so it's not like he's falsely humble about it, but he's a good guy.
What is he like when he's around his father? Is he a different person? Does he become the kid?
No.
Is he always the kid?
Not a different person. It's more like they're friends.
Oh, that's
they're,
good.
They're equals. It's definitely not that he falls into a yes or no sir thing. It's that they hug each other. And I mean, I didn't have dinner with them or anything, but it's just you can tell that they're close.
Yeah,
and that Rory will always or very frequently talk about the support. You know, his father was a barman at the club that he grew up in, and took on two extra jobs to help finance Rory's amateur career. I mean, they did not come from money at all. And his mother, you know, likes not to be in the spotlight very much, but she's a salt of the earth type too. I've met her, so it's a normal middle class family with loyalty to each other and pride in each other, and it's just wonderful. It's a wonderful story.
And that, my friend, is the perfect segue to your article, Golf's Biggest Illusions, 9 Things People Say About the Game That Aren't True, and 1 That Is, and number 1 you have, Golf is Only for Rich People.
Yeah.
there you go. That was, I think, your testimony.
The most common, you know, I can't tell you how many people talk about that when they first hear golf to me. And I mean, the easiest way, only 10% of the 26 million golfers in the United States belong to private clubs.
And shrinking.
And
it is shrinking, isn't it?
It is shrinking.
Those numbers are going down.
A little bit. And the rest people play, I mean, not that some of the rest aren't wealthy, but they play primarily at public courses where the average cost per round on weekends, rack rate with cart is $43 a round.
Really? Now, come on. I live in Northern California. If I were able to find a weekend rate with a cart for $43, I would be bragging more about that than my score. There's no way I can get something that low. I can't barely on the week.
That is the U.S. average, so we're factoring in rural North Dakota in there, too. But the place where I played until recently was a public course here. We live about 25 miles north of New York City, and that's about what the weekend rates were with cart. If you lived in the township and bought a $60 yearly pass, that's what it was. For non-residents, it was $60.
But the idea that golf is only for rich people, I think, goes beyond the club membership element. I think that golf itself is an expensive hobby because every time you want to go out and play, it's going to cost you. You're always being slammed by equipment hitting you in the face. Not like you need to change that every 6 months that the manufacturers want you to think you need to do, but you always got to go out and buy balls. You got to get gloves. You need shoes. It's like most hobbies. Golf is expensive. It's just one of the more expensive ones.
It's not a cheap thing. It's not like playing basketball or tennis. You just need a ball and a court, basically.
Right. Right.
That's for soccer. And that's one reason soccer is so popular around the world, is it's really just you need a field and a ball.
And a couple of guys. I mean, you can play soccer with two people, like basketball. You can play by yourself, you can play with two, you can play with ten.
But it's not, you can be middle class and you could easily have a very active golf life, for $1,000 a year, which is, money that a lot of people don't have, but it's not, doesn't require you to be rich to be a golfer. When I think of golfers, most people I've played with over my life, I think of, well, partly because of where I live here north of New York now, firemen and policemen who played at this course all the time. In the day they were off duty, and retirees on pensions. That in my mind is who plays golf as much as the people at private clubs.
Yeah, I seem to play a lot with self-employed construction people, and firemen definitely fall into that. I see a lot of firemen who also freelance, or if you want to call it freelance, moonlight, doing construction work. And there's a lot of self-employed people who are out there. Golf is work is just an excuse to pay for golf. I've heard said many times.
Right. Yeah, no, I was able to play when in the middle of the week a lot when the rates were lower, when I was more of a freelance writer. But in the summer, a lot of school teachers that weren't, in school, and bartenders, people that worked at night. It's interesting.
So, it's definitely one of the delusions that most people who don't play think of golf as it's just for rich people. No question about it.
Right.
But there are other delusions that golfers have about golf that you cover. And I'm going to skip one here. We'll get back to it. I just love this one. In Scotland, golfers never take longer than 3 hours to play a round. Everyone talks about the problem with golf is it takes too long, it's too hard, it's too expensive. You're covering this now that we've already got the expensive part out of the way. And now the length of time that's spent out on the golf course, it's a full day activity.
It's the most vexing problem in American golf is the pace of play, because we play in sequence. Unlike on a ski hill, you can go whatever rate you want. Everybody's passing each other. Golf is in sequence, and you're a victim to the slowest moving group ahead of you. But everybody says in Scotland, in Scotland they all play in 3 hours a round. So I called the chief executive of the Scottish Golf Union to talk to him at some length about the pace of play that people play there. His name is Hamish Gray. And he says 4 hours is the typical pace of play in Scotland for a four ball. Now, they do alternate shot a lot, sort of after lunch rounds where two players play one ball and they can get around faster.
Wait. Two players play with one ball?
Yeah, it's alternate shot, like in the Ryder Cup. It's called foursomes, confusingly enough to us. But a lot of times people, if they're going to play a full day of golf, they'll play a match play in the morning, they'll have an alcoholic lunch, and then they'll go out and play in about 2.5 hours, just, you know, two people against two other people. They're playing one ball each team, and they just alternate. So one guy hits the ball, and the other guy goes up while they're hitting and is ready to hit it again, and they really can get around the course fast. It's a lot of fun to play.
Yeah,
of course,
you
can't do it on a crowded course.
Well, I also I've not played in Scotland. I hope to sometime. But from what I've seen, I don't see a lot of big trees on the golf courses like I do in the parkland courses of the U.S. Am I wrong in thinking that we spend more time looking for lost balls than they do in Scotland?
There is a lot of thick gorse
and
grass that it can go into. But generally, they do have wider fairways and more area in play.
Mm-hmm.
So it speeds up the game somewhat.
Yeah.
The other big difference, the point to be made, though, is that the Scots really do play in 4 hours. And that if you play longer than that, you really are considered outside the pale of civilized behavior over there. Whereas in the United States, 4 hours is some sort of ideal that people want to play in, but almost very, very few courses actually get people around at that speed. Another reason they all play faster, though, is they play match play, and their handicap system is different, where they don't record their full strokes every time they play to have a valid handicap. They're designated rounds in tournaments at clubs, you know, little courses and clubs, and those are the rounds that are counted for handicap. So they have no compulsion to record every stroke and putt everything out. If they've lost the hole, they've lost the hole. It's a game, match play game, and so they go around and play a lot faster in that way.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, here's my opportunity for my editorial on why things are slow here as well. And my friends who play with me know that I generally have a very good attitude. I don't get too upset, except when a marshal comes around to tell me we're moving too slow. I appreciate that they're out there because they get to drive around in the cart and tell people things that they're moving too slow and that they get a free round of golf this week because of it. But if you want me to speed up, Mr. Marshall, keep your little cart in the fairway and watch where every ball goes. Then when one of the four of us loses a ball or hits an errant shot, which generally happens on almost every hole,
right,
you can say it's right here and we don't have to spend 5 or 6 minutes looking for everybody's ball. So if they would just please, marshals, just watch where the ball is. Take your hat off. Throw it down if it goes in the rough and just let me find it quickly instead of telling me that the group in front of me who's all 19 years old and play for the college team are a hole and a half ahead of us.
A good point.
Shut up. John Paul, I need to ask a favor here. We've already exceeded our 30-minute, when I put a 30-minute limit on these podcasts because you're at the gym and you need to get off the running machine. Could you stick around and talk to me some more about this article? We can do a members-only episode?
Oh, sure.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. We are going to continue this conversation about his article, Golf's Biggest Delusions, that comes from the February 25th, 6th, Saturday, Sunday issue of the Wall Street Journal. You should definitely check it out. Or join Golf Smarter for members only and hear part two of this conversation, and we'll discuss the whole thing. You won't have to read it at all. It's kind of like an audiobook, but it's a podcast. So, stick around. John Paul, thanks so much for coming on Golf Smarter.
You bet.
Recently, you may have noticed that I ask each guest to stick around for part two of our conversation, like I've done with John Paul, mostly because I'm finding them incredibly interesting and have so many more questions to ask before they leave. Well, not only is John Paul coming back next week to finish the points of his article, but coming soon, legendary coach Jim Hardy, who has worked with hundreds of PGA Tour players and is considered the father of the one-plane, two-plane swing concept, will join us for two parts, nearly an hour and a half. to discuss his latest book, Solid Contact. Basically, he contends that if we focus on ball flight, not the point of contact, you'll become a much better and much happier ball striker. Plus, he's got a very simple plus-minus system to correct your mistakes. It's a big deal for us to score this interview, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. But to hear it all, you need to help keep this listener-supported podcast alive by joining Golf Smarter for members only at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.